This is an audio commentary for Course 2 in Cosmology. And this talk is intended to match the first block in that course, Block 101. Title of this talk is Gravity, Buoyancy, and the Organic Light. Now, I'm beginning with a little talk about gravity based on an interchange that occurred when I presented some talks about Flat Earth on the Mandela Effect Decoded channel. And that would have been in July and August of 2018. At one point in one of those talks, I said, quote, "I don't believe in gravity." Well, that remark brought a comment, and I felt required or compelled or obliged to correct myself or clarify myself. So I begin with that little exchange. Obviously, the statement sounds absurd on the face of it. I don't believe in gravity. It sounds like I deny the phenomenon attributed to gravity, falling bodies mainly. And of course, I don't deny that falling bodies happen. I don't deny the common sense and intuitive evidence of what is alleged to be gravity. Certainly not. As this topic came up, I realized that the development of EU plasma cosmology, the electric universe paradigm, stands in the avant-garde of the superlearning event. Well, likewise, it should stand in the fundamental or initial lessons of the Nemeta course on cosmology. If you want to put this course and this topic in the framework of the superlearning event, you can consider that cosmology is a study overseen by Urania, or Tara, in the Shakti cluster. Tara, of course, means the bridge, Drolma, and this cosmology is the bridge between mythopoiesis and hard science in the living dream of Sophia. In my opinion, as well, it is also one of the more exciting learning curves in the superlearning event. So on to my comment. I wrote, you might want to look into electric universe plasma cosmology theory, which disputes the dogma of gravity with strong and consistent arguments. Don't assume that because I don't accept the conventional idea of gravity and how it works, I deny the obvious phenomena attributed to gravity. Of course not. I don't deny what gravity is said to do or supposed to do. As will be explained here, even Isaac Newton himself admitted that he could not identify the cause of gravitational effects. Everyone who is seriously interested in cosmology today needs to look into the final paragraphs of the Principia Mathematica, and I will return to that text in the course of this commentary. So I continue to write on the MED channel. Also, Newton screwed up the math. He added the product of two masses to Kepler's third law with no logical or provable justification. Thus, he introduced the glitch of gravity, an alleged force which he was unable to detect, into the calculations of physics. Of course, the phenomena attributed to gravity happens. It's seen mainly in falling objects. But the force of gravity believed to make that happen is a fallacious idea. That insight, that statement, that proposition is absolutely fundamental to Sophianic cosmology, in common with the EU paradigm. Now, there are some excellent refutations of the dogma of gravity on YouTube, and if one investigates them for a few hours, it's worth the effort. If you are willing to change your cosmic views, this is the place to start. And I would advise that everyone go and listen to the work of my friend and colleague, my brother in California, Robert Otey, O-T-E-Y. Now, I say that gravity is a dogma because it is just that, and only that. It's like the belief in God, that God sent his Son to earth to die for our sins. Many people believe that. That is a religious dogma. Equally so, many people accept gravity as if it were a religious dogma. It becomes a matter of religious conviction, but unfortunately, in the case of gravity, they're not aware that they are making that choice because they think that the theory of gravity and the force of gravity are self-evident and have been sufficiently proven. Certainly not the case. So Newton, Isaac Newton, in the closing page of his Principia Mathematica, makes a remarkable statement about gravity. Now, I advise some research on the internet. You know that I've made the defining statement for Nemeta that it is an in-life program. And I want the students of NEMETA to get out of cyberspace and get away from the computer as much as possible. But the internet can still serve as a learning device and a sort of classroom in its own right. So there was a talk given at the Thunderbolts conference in 2015 by A.P. Davis. And that is an excellent talk. I would advise that talk as a supplementary study to this Block 101 of cosmology. A.P. Davis remarks that Isaac Newton wrote the Principia at the demand of Edmund Halley, who was the astronomer after which Halley's comet is named. I didn't know this. Apparently, Halley was a contemporary of Newton. Whether they were close friends or colleagues, I don't know. The very great fact is that Newton's primary interests in life were, one, alchemy, upon which he wrote thousands of pages, two, astrology, upon which he also wrote voluminously, and three, the subject of chronology or biblical chronology related to other systems of chronology, which I suppose must have included the chronology of the equinoxes, of precession. That is to say, Newton was fascinated with the framework of the world ages, and in that respect, I can certainly relate to his interests. As you know, I've written pretty extensively on that subject myself. So according to A.P. Davis, Newton wasn't particularly interested in writing about physical laws, although apparently he was a brilliant mathematician. So Halley urged him to write a master text, and he did so. That's the Principia Mathematica. But it was not for Newton the primary interest of his life. It might have been something more like a hobby or an assignment that was given to him by an elder colleague or a close friend. In any case, in the brilliant but challenging talk by A.P. David, who is a Homerist and a Greek scholar, you hear some marvelous passages spoken in Greek from the ancient Greek scientists who were, by the way, followers or proponents of the heliocentric system. The phrase from Heraclitus, pantare, everything flows, is in itself an entire statement of cosmology. Life is motion. Everything in the cosmos is moving, including the earth, and the sun around which the earth rotates, and all of the stars and all of the planets, everything is moving together and spun into a cosmic dance. It's only the unmoved mover, which is a term from Aristotle, or the primal ground, parasamvit, described by the analogy of the obsidian mirror in my work, that does not move. Obviously, there has to be something that does not move for motion to be relative to. Motion is relative to what is motionless. And you can see what does not move by just looking at the night sky. And there is that blackness that does not move. But everything else moves, doesn't it? So everything flows. Panta Rei is a beautiful meme of ancient wisdom that contradicts the flat earth idea of an immobile earth at the center of a static and staged cosmos. The earth moves in ways that are not immediately detectable to the creatures living upon it and living in the world setting. That point, by the way, the preclusion in your field of sensation of the ensemble of cosmic motion around you is one that comes up in the talks on the phenomorphic field. So, why is it set up in this way? Just want to speculate for a moment before I go back to the subject of Newton's view of gravity. Well, obviously, it's set up for comfort. Imagine riding on a jet if you felt the direct and actual effects of moving at 550 miles an hour. You wouldn't be too comfortable. Actually, I took the Concorde from Paris to New York and back, and it did over Mach 2. That is, I think it did 2.3 something, more than twice the speed of sound. It went through the sound barrier twice. And I can assure you that there was not a quiver inside that cabin, inside the passenger cabin. Not a quiver. Not the slightest tremor on the surface of a glass of champagne. The bubbles of champagne were not disturbed by the fact that I was traveling at over 2 times the speed of sound. Figure it. So if humans can do that, what can nature do to selectively preclude the sensation of motion and other sensations as well? So raise that question as a little teaser, and you'll find more commentary and development of that issue in the course, in the essays called In the Phenomorphic Field. And that material can be found in the course on sky watching. So now let's return to the Principia by Newton. In the second edition, which was published in 1713, he added, which is called something called a scholium, S-C-H-O-L-I-U-M, meaning a commentary, just like this commentary I'm making now. A footnote. This is a footnote to a massive, I don't know, 500-page document written originally in Latin. Massive document. Foundation stone of modern physics, of Newtonian physics. And at the end, you come to 3 or 4 paragraphs stuck on as a kind of final thought. And in those paragraphs, you find in the original Latin this expression, which is often quoted: hypotheses non fingo, I feign no hypotheses, or I frame, I make no hypotheses. So Newton said he made no hypotheses concerning what? Well, concerning gravity. Now that's quite a shocking statement, because most people would say that Newton introduced the main hypothesis about gravity to explain how all that moves in the great cosmic dance has a material coherence. So the moon, the earth, the other planets, the sun, the galactic arms, all of it is moving in a cosmic dance, but all of it has a certain coherence because those masses are held together by the force of gravity, right? Wrong. That is not correct. And one of the first things for everyone to understand in Sophianic cosmology is that gravity has not been proven as a force fitting the description given to it. The allegations concerning gravity have not been proven in the court of reason. And secondly, you can say more or less that gravity as such, in the classical Newtonian sense, does not exist. So what actually did Isaac Newton do in this magnum opus of modern science? Well, he contrived a formula for gravity. That's all. And this form, and as the basis of this formula, he used Kepler's third law. And he incorporated into Kepler's third law, which is the law of motions of planetary bodies, the addition of two masses in order to create what is called the law of gravity. He did not hypothesize about the force of gravity. He did not explain the force that causes the phenomena of gravity, such as bodies falling to the earth or the moon spinning around the earth, all the planets in the solar system holding in a formation by the coordination of their masses. Okay, it has to do with mass, right? Weight and mass. He didn't explain any of that. He just introduced or proposed a formula to describe it. But he admitted, and here I will read directly from the text, I have not as yet been able to discover the reason for these properties of gravity from phenomena, and I do not feign hypotheses. For whatever is not deduced from the phenomena must be called a hypothesis. And hypotheses, whether metaphysical or physical, or based on occult properties or mechanical, have no place in experimental philosophy. In this philosophy, particular propositions are inferred from the phenomena and afterwards rendered general by induction. So, end quote. What Newton is saying here is he knows exactly how science should work. It should pay attention to the phenomena, and then it should introduce a hypothesis based on phenomena, and afterwards extrapolate that hypothesis into a more general paradigm or into a universal law or universal formula. He knows how to do that, and he's saying here that he hasn't done that in his Principia. Isn't that amazing? And also, when he uses the term have no place in experimental philosophy, what he called experimental philosophy at the beginning of the 18th century, later on in that century and in the beginning of the 19th century, was defined as natural philosophy. And the great leaders of natural philosophy were Goethe and other German scientists. And it's a very great fact that most of the genuine discoveries in science and in the so-called laws of nature that came about from the 17th and 18th centuries coming toward the 19th century were accomplished by Germans. So, let me read a little more from this scolium. Hitherto, we have explained the phenomena of the heavens and of our sea by the power of gravity, but have not yet assigned the cause of this power. Do you realize what he's saying? He's saying that the phenomena of the heavens, meaning the attraction of the heavenly bodies, and the phenomena of the sea, meaning the tides, are due to the power of gravity. But he has not detected what this power actually is. So he's calling the power that causes these things to happen gravity, but he's making no hypothesis about gravity because he hasn't physically detected how gravity works. This is certain, I'm quoting again, that it must proceed from a cause that penetrates to the very centers of the sun and planets without suffering the least diminution of its force, that it operates not according to the quantity of the surfaces of the particles upon which it acts, as mechanical causes used to do, but according to the quantity of the solid matter, that would be mass, which they contain, and propagates its virtue on all sides to immense distances, decreasing always as the inverse square of the distances. So here he is proposing a mathematical formula that says that this force decreases always as the inverse square of the distances from the bodies upon which it is acting and between which it is acting. But he in fact knows not what such a force is. He has no empirical evidence of any such force. So he's not hypothesizing the force, which can only be done if you have evidence for the force. He's merely providing a mathematical formula that describes how the force works, or how he thinks it should work. This is the foundation of gravity, and all subsequent notions about gravity and its work in the cosmos derive from this botched job of Isaac Newton. You know, I suspect that very few students in high school and very few college students and even graduates in science and astronomy actually know these passages that I'm reading now. And they do not have the opportunity, I would guess, to make the obvious inferences here. So I'm going to read just two more, the next to the last, and then the last paragraph, because the last paragraph is a stunner. The next to the last paragraph, he says, it begins, "Hitherto I have not been able to discover the cause of those properties of gravity from phenomena, and I frame no hypotheses." And he continues, "Thus it was the impenetrability, the mobility, and the impulsive force of bodies, and the laws of motion and gravitation that were discovered. And to us it is enough that gravity does really exist, and act according to the laws which we have explained, and abundantly serves to account for all the motions of the celestial bodies and of our sea." So you can see this is Newton's disclaimer. Can you see that? Can almost sense that he wrote this at the end of the book, knowing that he didn't prove the force of gravity exists and he cannot demonstrate it on empirical terms. But at least he provides a law that explains how it appears to behave. And since the law does seem to work, then you can say that it is enough that gravity really does exist. But it's not a direct proof of gravity, it's only an inference from his law. Now it turns out that this law is utterly wrong, and it has been disproven by an Iranian woman. Robert O'Tay quotes and cites her work. An Iranian woman, a mother and housewife with two kids. Iranian, quite interesting, right? The Magi came from Iran. Proved that adding the mass of two bodies and incorporating those quantities into Kepler's third law was a mistake and doesn't make any sense. How come then that Newton's law of gravity became a foundational tool of physics? It's because it appears to work up to a certain point. It appears to work in certain limited applications. The unfortunate side of this law is that it is so wrong fundamentally as a description of the cosmos that astronomers and physicists following Newton, including Einstein and others, have had to invent all kinds of fictional entities to account for the fact that this law does not hold up to scrutiny and it cannot be applied universally to the phenomenon of the cosmos. So black holes, quasars, dark matter, dark energy, all of these hypothetical fictions of mathematical physics exist today because of the primary fault in Newton's law of gravity. All right, now, tighten your seatbelts, because this is the final paragraph, the final paragraph. Quote, "And now we might add something concerning a certain most subtle spirit, which pervades and lies hid in all gross bodies, by the force and action of which spirit, the particles of bodies attract one another at near distances and cohere if contiguous. And electric bodies," note that, "electric bodies operate to greater distances, as well repelling as attracting the neighboring corpuscles. And light is emitted, reflected, refracted, inflected, and heats bodies. And all sensation is excited, and the members of animal bodies move at the command of the will, namely, by the vibrations of this spirit, mutually propagated along the solid filaments of the nerves, from the outward organs of sense to the brain, and from the brain to the muscles. But these are things that cannot be explained in few words, nor are we furnished with that sufficiency of experiments which is required to an accurate determination and demonstration of the laws by which this electric and elastic spirit operates." The last six words of the Principia Mathematica: "This electric and elastic spirit operates." So what do you make of that? Well, what I make of it is that Newton, who is coming from the, really from the viewpoint of an occultist who studied alchemy, was more deeply interested in alchemy than in astronomical physics, had the intuitive perception, and he might have even had the mystical perception or the mystical intuition that there is an electrifying force that operates through the universe in material bodies, not only the planetary bodies, but animal bodies. See that he makes a point about this same force working in the animal bodies. So there is one force that operates through the planetary bodies, the other that operates and at the same time uniformly in the bodies of animal creatures, which would be human creatures and other animals, in all that is alive. And he describes it as this electric and elastic spirit. So the very last paragraph of his work, of his masterwork, is to my mind the most important paragraph of all. It points ahead to plasma cosmology. It points ahead to Sophianic animism. Sophianic animism is not just a religion, but it is a frame of science. It's a framing paradigm for science. Newton, being an alchemist, knew that the planets, being an astrologer as well, knew that the planets were traditionally referred to as animals. The planets, that is, those lights that move through the sky, as distinguished from the relatively unmoving lights in the background, plane meaning wanderer, those wandering lights he understood to be animated creatures, animated bodies. And the same elastic and electric force operating through those animating bodies operates in the human animal right down into the sensations that are excited along the nerves and propagated through the filaments of the nerves from the outward organs of sense to the brain and from the brain into the muscles. So the very same force that animates and moves those planetary bodies moves all that lives upon this planet. Newton knew that. That's where he ended up. That's where he was coming from. And all the rest of it was just a big exercise in intellectual masturbation. So what else is new? So in this audio commentary that opens the first block of cosmological studies for Nemata, I offer you this gift. You can go into the world and talk to other people about physics and astronomy knowing something that most experts don't even know. And you can talk with the confidence of knowing that gravity doesn't exist and that there has to be another explanation and another force. That explains, for instance, why the oceans of the Earth and the atmosphere are not ripped away by the motion of the Earth as it spins on its axis. You know, one of the incendiary issues in this unfortunate flat Earth controversy concerns that question of the oceans and the atmosphere, but particularly the oceans. Flat Earthers are demanding proof of the oceans being curved. They say the ocean is flat wherever you go, and therefore there's no proof of curvature of the ocean. They're using the word proof wrongly. It should be the word evidence. There's no evidence of curvature of the ocean. Bear in mind that proof is a product, and evidence is an item or component in that product. So just as you would construct a device from various parts, like you would construct a lawnmower from various parts, such as the handle, the blade, the wheels, and so forth, you construct a proof from various parts of evidence. So they're always crying for proof, 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 which shows that they don't have their syntax straight. Proof is something that comes as a construction built upon evidence, built upon a variety of evidence and built upon specific components of evidence. And when that construction is made, then a conclusion is drawn and the proof is seen to be a valid proof or an invalid proof. So one of the arguments that flat earthers make is that the Earth cannot be spinning on its axis at 1,000 miles per hour at the equator and hurtling through space at 18 miles per second, or otherwise, how would the ocean, how would the body of water attached to the Earth remain upon the surface of the Earth? And so those who would wish to, most of those, unfortunately, who want to refute the flat earthers on this point, refer to gravity, which is a grave error. And so they say, well, the reason why the ocean doesn't spin out off the surface of the globe is because gravity holds it to the Earth. This is not true. This is not correct. So be clear on this point as well. In this cosmology of the Sophianic and Gnostic paradigm, you're never going to use gravity to explain anything. So how would I explain the evidence? What is the evidence? The evidence is there's evidence and inference. There's an inference that the Earth is spinning on its axis and moving through the sky around the sun. And there's evidence that the oceans, the watery body of the Earth, it doesn't dissipate. Due to the spinning motion, it does not get discharged from the surface of the Earth, does it? Well, why not? In considering this question, it's helpful to do a little modeling. Now, I'm going to give you my example of the modeling. You can do it on your own. In my example, I've taken the dimension of the Earth, which is a diameter of 7,900 miles. So across the globe of the Earth, that's the measured diameter. We're, of course, adopting the spherical model here, not because it is absolutely true and correct, and not because it's the only way to look at the Earth in its shape and in its motions, but simply because as a provisional model, you use it to see what you can learn from it. Use the model to see what the model will show you, what it will tell you. It will tell you some things about what you already know, and it will possibly, if it's a good model, lead you on to other things you don't yet know. So, the diameter of the Earth is about 7,900 miles, and the maximum depth of the ocean is said to be known depth in the Mariana Trench of about 8 miles. But actually, the depth of the ocean is not 8 miles at all points. The ocean is really shallow in many, many places, not only at the coast, but out in the middle of the ocean. It's much more shallow. So let's just say that we take 4 miles for the average depth of the ocean. And if you divide 4 by 7,900 miles, you get 0.00051. So that's the proportion of the depth of the ocean to the extent of the mass, material mass of the planet. Now convert that to another model. Let's say that the Earth is in front of you, modeled as a sphere that is 20 feet in diameter. That is 240 inches in diameter, 12 times 20. So you measure 240 inches, or you multiply 240 inches by 0.00051, and you get 0.1224 inches, which is about 8 64ths of an inch, or about an eighth of an inch, about 3.1 millimeters. So that means that on a model sphere, 20 feet in diameter, the surface of the ocean, surface of the watery part of the material body of the planet, is an eighth of an inch. So it does. What kind of force then does it take to cause this thin layer of water to adhere to the immense material mass of the body? Those who argue gravity are wrong. It's not the force of gravity that causes that thin film of water to adhere to the Earth body, to the planetary mass. It's rather more something like static electricity. You know how static electricity can cause pieces of paper or strands of hair to cling to a comb? You walk across the carpet and you get a spark from the static electricity. You touch something and you get a spark. That's the electricity that is running through those electric and plastic forces that Newton indicated. Electrical and plastic. We'll get to the plastic part in a moment. So it's actually, according to EU cosmology, the electricity that is the foundation force in the universe, it's called Akasha in Sanskrit cosmology, that is the cause of the watery body, the watery film, because it is just a film, adhering to the material mass of the Earth. So get really, really clear on that. Picture that. You know, when I heard Bucky Fuller talk in LA back in the 70s, I'll never forget his demonstration of the same or a similar model. Bucky Fuller, however, Buckminster Fuller, inventor of the geodesic dome, was a small autistic genius of a dwarf-like build, probably about 5 foot, if that, if not 4'8". And he stood there on stage in front of a large metal sphere that was at least 6 feet tall, maybe 8 feet tall. And he went up to this metal sphere and breathed on it with his breath, and then he turned and he said, That's what the atmosphere of the Earth is like compared to the mass of the Earth. So Bucky Fillo was talking about the atmosphere in the same manner that I'm here talking about the ocean. So you have two layers of film upon the material body of the Earth. You have the aqueous or watery film, which we call the ocean, covering 70% or more of the surface of the globe. And you have the aerial film, or the atmosphere, which is called in Ptolemy and in the ancient sciences, Greek science, the ambient, A-M-B-I-E-N-T. The ambient is the zone of livable atmosphere. And it turns out, I think, that the zone of livable atmosphere is also about 7 miles high. I think you can go up 7 miles, and that's the limit of where breathable oxygen is available. So there's your model. Use that model. Refer back to that model. And you never have to refer to gravity in order to know why the atmosphere in its double layers adheres to the planet, even though the planet is moving at tremendous speed in space, dancing and spinning through space. Gaia, Sophia, the living planet, is a sky dancer, a Dakini. So having covered that material, we come to the home stretch of this audio commentary. And that brings us to the moment to look at the subject of buoyancy. There's a lot of talk about gravity and really little talk about buoyancy or levity. Now, it just may turn out that the development of EU plasma cosmology will incorporate the concept of buoyancy. I don't know if it has so far. I haven't been able to follow every single development and parallel in the Thunderbolts school, the Thunderbolts gang. Also, I would just note in passing that even though there's a lot to be learned from them, they are still adhering to certain archaic aspects of atomic theory, and they haven't really reached, I would say, the completion of their own worldview. But it's developing in a way that looks more and more like it could be a complement or daughter science to Sophianic cosmology. Remember that Tara is the bridge. The fallen goddess scenario is a mythopoetic version of an astronomical event. And you will be crossing the bridge or standing on the bridge between that mythopoetic narrative and the actual hard scientific narrative of astronomical physics. So buoyancy, well, go back to the last words of Newton's magnum opus. This electric and elastic spirit. Elastic, well, that's an interesting phrase, an interesting term. What's elastic? Well, you know, if you think of a yo-yo and then think of a bungee cord. Now, a bungee cord's elastic. So if I hold one end of the bungee cord and I hook something on the other end, like, let's say, a bag full of walnuts, and that has a certain weight, and I move my hand up and down, then the bag of walnuts does not merely move up and down in coordination with the movement of my hand, but due to the elastic property of the bungee cord, it has another motion, doesn't it? And likewise, if you play with a yo-yo, curiously, the yo-yo, the line of the yo-yo string is not an elastic string, but in the way that the yo-yo operates, because it winds and unwinds itself on that string, it has a quasi-elastic property. So the properties of elasticity and buoyancy belong to science, and they can be found everywhere in nature. Go and look at a tree. Go stand by a tree and reach out and touch a branch of that tree. Put your hand on the top of the branch and push the branch down slightly, and then pull your hand away, and what happens? Well, the branch springs back, doesn't it? Look at the growth of fiddlehead ferns. Look at the unfoldment of all flowers. They're of all the plants in the natural world. Look at the way they unfold. Look at the way they push up out of the earth. That's buoyancy. There's buoyancy everywhere. Look at the movement of sap up the tree. That's buoyancy. It's not entirely explainable by the action of the capillaries, I believe. The quality of buoyancy and levity, those two qualities, need to become more and more closely associated in your mind with the organic light on the one hand and with plasma on the other hand. Let me correct something I just said. Akasha, or akasha, is the Sanskrit name for plasma, which is an electrified medium, a kind of electrified gas. Remember that. What is the definition of life to the aeons? What does life look like to the pleuromic aeons? The electrified animation of colloids. Okay? So, electrified animation, the electrified medium of plasma, which is the fourth state of matter, solid, liquid, gaseous, and then plasma. These are the building blocks of your cosmology, and you share them with astronomical science. The solid material body of the Earth, first form of matter, first state of matter. Water, the aqueous body of the Earth, second state of matter. Air, the atmospheric body or sheath of the Earth, third state of matter. And four, plasma. But where is the plasma? Where's the plasmatic component of the material body of the Earth? Where is that? Now, I advise that everyone who studies Sophianic cosmology look into the work of Christian Birkeland, a Norwegian scientist who lived from 1867 to 1917, The Northern Lights by Lucy Jago, J-A-G-O, is required reading for this course. The Northern Lights, of course, that's a reference to a Mandela effect, the Sally Fields, the dancing fields. Sally means dancing, vibrating. The Northern Lights are the Sally Fields of the planet. If you investigate the discovery of the concept of plasma, the discovery of the concept, putting it on the map by definition, you'll come across the work of Irving Langmuir, who lived a little later than Birkeland. He's an interesting character, worked with a few other people. He invented the incandescent lamp in Socorro, New Mexico, back in my old home country. It was Langmuir who defined plasma as the fourth state of matter. This discovery, if you call it that, came up while he was experimenting with inert gases such as argon. Now, I've talked about argon in the Gaia navigation experiment in the context of Gaia's golden seam. And I've said that argon is actually the chemical component of that increment of human consciousness which the human species adds to the consciousness of the planet. You know, argon is called an inert gas, and you don't hear very much about it, do you? You hear a lot about CO2 from the climate change alarmists. But actually, argon is more preponderant in the atmosphere of the Earth than CO2. So why don't you hear people talking about argon? It takes Gurdjieff and myself to bring your attention to argon. So Langmuir, Langmuir, called this fourth state of matter plasma because it reminded him of blood plasma. That is to say, it suggested to him the properties of a living medium. Well, that's my case. Where do I differ from the EU cosmology, plasma cosmology people? I differ in that I insist that plasma is alive, that it has the properties of a living and animating creature, that it has sensorial properties, it can sense, it has cognitive properties, and it has cognitive or intentional properties. So I maintain that plasma is alive. This is a fundamental principle of Sophianic animism, of course. In a future science that you are learning and teaching in the superlearning event, plasma is known to be a biophysical medium. Biophysical. It's not just a physical force. It's biophysical. It's also biopsychic. The operations of plasma as a physical medium, irrespective of its animating and animated properties, is, of course, the main concern of EU cosmology, electric universe. And to get onto that boat, you look at the work of Hans Alfen, who lived from 1908 to 1995, and he is, as it were, the godfather of plasma cosmology. So in concluding, I want to put a question before you. Would it be possible, as the future science develops rapidly and massively in the coming years, to incorporate recognition of buoyancy and levity into the operations of nature? As I've said, there is no lack of evidence of buoyancy in nature. The very fact of plants growing out of the earth, the very fact that a stalk of wheat that I often see in the fields of Belgium, stalk of wheat grows to maybe 3 feet high. It has a heavy, heavy head. And yet that stalk of wheat with its thin stalk can stand upright due to buoyancy. Trees have buoyancy. A tree floats in the atmosphere. It's a living demonstration of buoyancy. Clouds? Did you ever notice those things called clouds? You know, clouds are extremely mysterious. Goethe studied clouds, was trying to understand the morphology of clouds. Few scientists today understand how clouds operate. For instance, it's a mystery to scientists the way that clouds form and the way that they behave over bodies of water as compared to the way they behave over land. I mean, elementary things like that are not known to scientists today. Why? Because the properties of buoyancy are not sufficiently acknowledged. And what is the most buoyant force in the universe? What is the most buoyant material in the universe? Well, that would be the organic light, which is a body of material luminosity of a foam-like or nougat-like substance that has the property, among others, of infinite density and zero mass. The organic light has zero mass, meaning that it is perfect and complete buoyancy. What you see as matter before your eyes material objects, rocks, which are subject to fall to the ground, everything that is present in the world event of a material mass floats in the organic light, which is a medium of total buoyancy. Now, I've described extensively the properties of the organic light, as you know. I've described at least probably 12 or 15 specific and verifiable attributes of the light. And in some cases, those who have encountered the organic light can verify what I have described, because everyone has the same experience with the light. One of the questions that stood before Longmire in the 1930s was the question of the activity of this medium called plasma, the fourth state of matter, within the presence of the other three states of matter in the material world. So there you are, facing the world event. The world event is present to you. I'm not saying that the ground you're standing on belongs to a spherical planet moving in space, or does it belong to a disc-shaped planet that doesn't move? It doesn't matter. Forget that. You're looking at a world event, and in this world event in which you are embedded, you can identify three states of matter: solid, liquid, and vapor. But where is the fourth state of matter in relation to those three? You know, the EU people, the Thunderbolts people, have not yet, as far as I know, got to the point of a pervasive and comprehensive recognition of plasma in the material physics of the planet. They go into a laboratory and they create plasmic discharges inside glass balls. And they use laboratory tools to simulate plasma flow and plasma discharges, and then they compare them to what they see in the outer reaches of space, such as in the Veil Nebula of Cygnus, or in certain discharges. They see plumes of this plasmic electricity discharging from galactic centers. Significantly, they see it discharging vertically rather than horizontally. I don't know if they have detected any instances of a plasma plume or discharge laterally across galactic limbs, which of course is the case in the Sophianic narrative, isn't it? So there you have it. Looking at the operations of plasma in the contrivances of a laboratory, and then looking out to the cosmos, because plasmic functions, plasmic activities are scalar, they are the same at all scales, right? But not looking at the plasmic or plasmatic substantiality that is present directly in the Earth. That's a mystical event. There is no instrument that can detect the organic light. But your physical body can detect it, and it does so by certain distinct and repeatable, uniform, verifiable sensations, such as a lowering of temperature. So finally, to come to the 60th minute of this audio commentary, I would ask you to direct your eyes to photographs that you've seen of the Andromeda Galaxy. Now, you can see the Andromeda Galaxy with your naked eye, and it appears to be like a thumbprint or purplish cream smudge in the sky, located in the constellation of Andromeda. This is one of the most ogled and photographed objects in the cosmos. Go look at a really good high-resolution picture of the Andromeda Galaxy, and what do you see? Well, you see, of course, a vortex, a spiral thought to be a four-armed lenticular spiral, quite similar to the galaxy we inhabit. So M31 is the twin or mirror to our galaxy. And when you look at the photograph, you see at the core of M31 this pure white creamy vortex. And then you see the limbs, and you know that those limbs are full of planetary systems. They're full of suns, which have mass, and they're full of planets and other cosmic material, if you want to call it that. So the arms of the galaxy, the limbs, have mass. The pure white luminosity of the core has no mass. Therefore, the galaxy floats. It floats on the armature of a mass-free vortex of organic light. You cannot imagine the weight of the masses in the galactic arms of just one galaxy is incalculably immense. Well, how can that weight float in space? It floats like an armature supported by the mass-free organic light, which is a medium of pure buoyancy. So that's the image to take away here. And that is the conception to bring to the picture of the Andromeda Galaxy every time you look at it. And as you do look at it, you might also try this little exercise. Don't picture the galaxy against the black background of space as simply floating in space, as if it were a flying saucer. You can only see one side of it at a time, so generally you're looking down on it, right, at an angle. You presume it has a bottom side. It's like a flying saucer floating in the blackness. As a matter of fact, it's not a free, it's not an independent lenticular body floating in the blackness. It's erupting out of the blackness. Remember that I said that every Panta ray, everything in the cosmos, flows and moves against the background of the immovable. So when you look at the white, milky, creamy core of the Andromeda Galaxy, what you see is the eruption of a massive vortex of organic light out of the black sea of superorganic light. The superorganic light is black. And yet that black medium, somehow mysteriously, the obsidian mirror, gives rise to the buoyancy that produces the manifest worlds. So I leave you with that image. And on that note, I conclude this audio commentary, which is designated AUD 2.101N. The letter N indicates that it is a new or novel addition to the courses in Nemeta, as distinguished from an audio commentary with the letter D, which indicates that it's derived or drawn from previous work and previous talks. But hold on, that is not quite the conclusion here. I need to add a couple of notes of correction. I said A.P. Davis. The gentleman's name is A.P. David, and he is worth looking up at Thunderbolts. I also may have said plastic instead of elastic a couple of times. The use of the word elastic by Newton in the final paragraph of his magnum opus is certainly telling. The properties of plasma are elastic. Also, elasticity infers buoyancy. And speaking of buoyancy, Again, let me clarify the syntax here. The vortex of mass-free organic light wells up out of the black sea of the superorganic light, which can be considered as an ore, a material. The blackness of the night sky is not merely the blackness of emptiness or the vacuum of space. There is no vacuum of space. That blackness is the substantiality of the superorganic light. So properly speaking, in the picture of the galaxy, as you visualize it and as you look at pictures of the Andromeda galaxy, you picture it in this way. The axis or hub of organic light with the armature of the galactic limbs. And it is embedded in superorganic light. When you see the picture of Andromeda, you look down on it as if you're looking down on one side. It only has one side. So, finally, with that image of the axis of buoyancy, you have a concept leading into the new physics. I believe that the axis of buoyancy is a concept that would take you in the direction of the vortex of stillness, or the vortices of stillness, in Russellian science. And for that study, I strongly advise you to go to Robert Otey. So that's the conclusion, and I will sign off with the formula phrase for cosmological and physical studies in Nemata. The subject of your great devotion is just what nature does, not what the human mind expects her to do.